from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jack Fortin. Today on the show, I continue with my quest to interview interesting people, and I found online someone who, for a while, I had kind of overlooked, not because there was any specific reason, but only because the title of his podcast made me think it was about a subject I wasn't really that interested about. My guest is the host of the Geologic Podcast, Mr. George Hrab. Thanks for joining me, George.
Sure, my pleasure. I guess your search ends here, right? This is where the non-interesting guests start speaking. So sorry about that, folks.
Yeah, well, he already makes... I like your style of apologizing before a show. You can tell he's taking comedy classes. He's like, well, if I try to ingratiate myself and I suck, at least I'll have the medium thing. And I'm not going to let you get away with that. Not on this show.
Oh, all right. You caught me. Yes, I am. I am awesome. So get ready for the awesomeness to pour out of every pore through this Skype connection.
There you go.
Into your ear holes. So here we go.
There you go. Pumping it up. That's right. That style.
I like that.
With the whole
nice
pump up style. The self-deprecating thing, I don't do. I don't know if you saw the cover for my upcoming DVD, but it's got me painted as Napoleon. Clearly, I have an
subtle
ego problem.
Subtle. That's nice. I like it.
Yeah, it's a little bit subtle.
Cool. So you weren't interested in my show because you thought it was what? It was about rocks? Is that what you assumed?
Well, no, here's what I assumed. I assumed it was just a show not about rocks, but about ages. See, geologic, if you do a search on Google and you just search geologic, what you get is a description of how certain people in science, namely geology, measure ages, time frames in deep time, because the Earth is old and fucking the crust of the Earth is like a big molten fucking pile of wet, at least as far as deep time is concerned. So it moves in ripples and shit like that. So you can't think of it in our tiny ant-like lifespans.
Right.
So I thought it was just kind of a broad... I don't know how you managed to have done 200 of them by then, but I'm like, surely this man must be a genius of geology to have done 200 shows on geology alone.
That's right. The minutia of geology. I just move at a very glacial pace. That's why it takes almost 300 shows to get my point across. No, there's no geology in it. It's very, very little. It's like 0.01% geology, I think, is in there. So
am I the only one to actually make that assumption?
Oh, no. I get lots of people. One of my favorite comments on I don't know if it was iTunes or somewhere, someone left a bunch of commentary about, you know, I tuned in, I'm a geologist, and I tuned in and I listened to the first show, and I listened to an hour, and there was no geology. So I came back and I thought, okay, weird. I listened to the second hour, and it's more of the same. It's stories about atheism, and there's some music, and there's some comedy bits, and there's no geology. So I came to a third hour, and I listened to the third hour, and there's still no geology. That's it. I'm unsubscribing. There's no geology in the show whatsoever. And I thought, it took you 3 hours to figure out that this is not a geology program?
You have to understand, this is the nature of podcasting now. I'm sure a lot of people are usually confused and said, how come when I listen to this one podcast that says it's about atheism, it's about something completely fucking different every show?
I guess. Weird. But then I do have a number of geologists that did tune in initially to listen to something related to their rock background and have stuck with it because they just found me so fascinating and curious and just hilarious.
Well, one of the confusing parts is that I tried to do a little bit of research because I went to your site and then I went to the About You section, which is a confusing audio file that only at the end, only after having listened to the entire thing, does it reveal that the show is about nothing. It's like a Seinfeld moment here where you're just like, well,
if only.
So I was a little bit confused by this fanfare. It still answered nothing. And while I think it's like a lot of people out there, they think to themselves, I have this list of people that I listen to, that I love already. Am I really willing to put this level of commitment now in trying to get to learn this new person?
Yeah. Nope, not worth it.
There you go. Well, that was the show. Jeez, it's
good
be
night,
short,
everybody.
Right? 5 minutes. Well, fuck you, everybody. Have a good night.
That's right.
But I think of that. So, your show, which has a confusing name, but yes, is nevertheless...
Do you understand the name, though? I mean,
probably the first three letters of your name plus the logic right after.
There you go. Okay.
It would make more sense if there's a fucking hyphen in there.
Hyphens are for amateurs, my friend. Hyphens are for amateurs.
No. You know what? If there is normal confusion, I think it's normal. I was just like, hey, it's cool that geologists have a bald dude on their side who's all like, watcha, at the screen. Which is what your logo looks like. First of all, that's what I thought. I did recognize the legitimacy of your show. I was just like, I don't think I like geology, and I can't figure out what the show's about. Those were my two main problems. That's why at first I didn't sort of get you. And I think it's probably like a lot of people out there have a similar experience to listen to my show. They probably just didn't get it at the beginning.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of Magritte, so I think that's the influence on the show's name, which is a very poor joke, but yeah, it's I like the idea that the name of my show really has nothing to do with it until you dig a little bit deeper and then you realize, oh, it's like a shitty pun, which is worth a death penalty, but fine. So I enjoy it, and it is a bit of a filter, so that if you get through the name and through the fact that there's no geology, then you're drawn in, and that's it, and then I've got you.
Well, maybe that gives me an idea. Maybe a suggestion for someone out there is if your personality that a person has to kind of get acclimatized to, get to start loving over time, because I think you mentioned on some of your previous interviews that, you know, the show is very personal. You reveal things that are personal about you.
Yeah.
And what that means is that people kind of have a weird one-sided relationship with you.
Very much so, yeah. It's a weird friendship. It's a one-sided friendship, but it's a legitimate friendship in that the people that listen to the show on a regular basis know a lot about me, and almost too much. And so sometimes when I meet these people in person, most are very cool about it and understand the one-sidedness of it. But you know, sometimes it's a little bit awkward when people know more about me or remember more about things that I've said than I do. That's when it gets a little bit awkward. So you have these kind of random references, and I have no concept what the person's talking about. You know, someone might come up to me and say, waffles. And I'll be like, okay, sure. You know, show 19, which was 5 years ago, and I have no clue of what I talked about on that program.
That's horrible.
That's fine. That's fine. I understand that. Because I'm ultimately as much of a fan of things as hopefully my fans are of me. And I understand what that mindset is like, to be excited about things or to be ensconced in the minutia of being interested in something. So I ultimately don't have a problem with that.
And it's true. And the more you make a person able to dig into that minutia, the more crack you give them, in a sense. You know, it is a drug.
Yeah.
It is the ability for someone to say, hey, you produce something that's interesting to me, and now I want it endlessly. Give it to me now. This produces a very strange relationship, because the individuals that are there being like, wow, this is so good, and they'll often praise you, can at the same time turn around and just sort of like, what the fuck, where's my crack?
Yeah, the... Yeah, again, I'm very fortunate, and then the majority of the vocal people, fans of mine or listeners of mine, are very, very cool, and they understand that this is one person creating this content, and they are really cool about, I mean, not that I really miss any weeks or anything like that, but for the most part, the comments that I do get are just like, hey, it's okay, take a break, it's cool, you know, as opposed to, where's this? The people that do make those kind of comments don't usually hang around very long, because I'm not very receptive to those kinds of comments.
Right. Well, that was actually the impression that I got throughout my research of you, which was generally that you dislike criticism specifically because it comes from people that you don't know, which I thought was weird. I mean, shouldn't it not matter? You don't know these people. If they say something and it's criticism, they're anonymous.
Oh no, I don't mind criticism. I mean, criticism is difficult, but I want criticism that is somewhat informed.
Right.
Criticism that has no ideas behind it, or that doesn't understand how things work, or it doesn't even have a ballpark concept of how things work, is really bothersome and annoying. And the assuming criticism are the ones that really sort of bother me too. Criticisms, you know, ultimately this content is free, so when someone comes to me and might have a complaint about you know, my content or the change of my content over time, there is no requirement for you to listen and tune in. Those are the most troublesome, that, you know, this show is created by me and its parameters fit exactly to the kind of show I want to produce. And I don't feel beholden to anyone. And that's the beauty of this silly format that we have, this podcasting format, is that you are only beholden to ultimately yourself and what you want to do. So the criticism I have the most problem with are either when someone says, you have changed your program for reason A, B, C, and D, or why don't you go back and do what you used to do previously? Whereas it's like, you know, the content is up to me. And if you don't enjoy it, you just don't have to listen. I don't understand the purpose of someone sort of coming out and commenting or complaining on it. Or you know, go ahead and say, hey, you know, your older shows were funnier, or your newer shows are better than they were, or you don't curse anymore because you're hoping to get, you know, to monetize the show or something. Like, it's just, they're just ignorant statements that ultimately I just don't understand the purpose of. Again, as a fan of...
But do you comment on other people's stuff? Like, what?
No,
you...
never.
See,
never.
That's the thing. You got to understand, though, the reason why you can't perceive that mentality is because your relationship as a fan isn't the same as the people that send the comments out there. So you don't understand them. If you were a person who sent out, say, an email to a guy's webcomic that you really love but who's never on time, and you're like, get your fucking act together... You know, you say that out of the person who writes that says that out of a place of love, a creepy love. And when they send it, they're like, well, surely he knows that I still love him. Ha ha ha. But
I'm real big on manners, though. Like, ultimately, I'm really big on being polite. You know, that to me is one of these wonderful distinctions between us and the animal kingdom, is a sense of manners. You know, and I think that's one of the few vestiges of humanity that we can hang on to, even while we're being turned into ones and zeros. There is still a base level politeness that I sort of insist upon.
Right, a kind of polite algorithm that you require to be pro.
Totally, yeah, to be functional. You know, this whatever operating system I have, there is a deep polite manners kind of subroutine that really drives the engine. And almost any kind of criticism can be taken if the first thing you say is sort of done with that thing of, gosh, I love the show, blah, 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 or whatever, or I think you're funny, or I think this or this, but I've noticed that this is happening. Then we're good, we're golden. I mean, I the way I get addressed sometimes through email or through a comment, and this is not particular to me in any stretch, this is the wonders that is the internet. People would never make those comments face to face. Never make those comments. That's my number one rule, is when I'm typing here, could I say this to the person face to face? Would I be comfortable saying it? And, you know, if I can honestly say that, yeah, I'd be comfortable saying this face to face, then it's fine. And that's my rule. And it doesn't matter if you know the person or not, if you're familiar with them or if you're a stranger, you know, whether you're a family member or whether you're just a random unknown entity that listens to my show, there is still a baseline of manners and politeness that apply. So that's my big.
I suppose, you know, one of the problems that people don't understand is that, in a sense, the anonymity means that there's no emotional context for you know, there at all. It's up to a person to interpret how it's supposed to be read, and that is the main issue. And I think everybody always. I think we assume the worst anyways when we read an email, regardless. We assume that something short is terse. We assume that, you know, a short sentence, the person must be mad.
Sure. So that's why it's doubly the person's responsibility who is making the email or the comment. If they don't want to, if you're mad and you want to be seen as mad or being a jerk or being a troll, great. That's your prerogative. But if your intention is to comment on something that you enjoy, then you have to make doubly sure, in the same way that, you know, if you have some, I had a problem with a listener who, and this is a weird area, but if you know that you yourself have a problem that is a diagnosed problem communicating in a way or reading emotional content in a way, you would think that if you've been diagnosed with that, you would use whatever skills you have.
Make special precautions.
Yeah, you know, use your analytical skills that you have, which obviously are off the chart. Use those analytical skills, those mathematical skills, to say, okay, is this communication being terse and unpolite and rude, or is it not? If I've been, you know, diagnosed with having this kind of condition that makes me incapable of determining either hearing, you know, sarcasm or hearing nastiness when I produce it or when it's said to me, then you would take like double precautions, you know what I mean? So, and then to top it all off, as an atheist, as a non-believer, I mean, then it should be triply important that I come across as understanding and caring, because for the most part, that's like, that's the whole thing that I'm trying to project as someone that can understand and can hear and can be not cautious, but that just can be fair and can be polite ultimately, so that if someone is spewing the most ridiculous fantasy at me, I can still hear them and not forgive them for it or give them a pass, but be a human being and be polite about it. So that, you know, it's interesting that you get this at the top of our conversation, because that does play into this, you know, this atheism thing of trying to be the best, the most polite, the most humane, the most human, and the smartest and the most gentle in the room, and then be seen as an atheist, you know, or then be seen as someone who doesn't have a supernatural belief system, which is trying to dictate what their behavior is, and that the behavior is enough. The behavior is the reason for the behavior, not because of God's punishment or Cthulhu's, you know, ultimate judgment.
Well, I think one of the things that I've talked about on past shows is something I call future crafting, right? It's why I think a show like Star Trek, for instance, is really popular. It's because we're used to looking back at mythology to try to make some semblance of life, to make some sense of it. Were our elders, our fathers, were they wise? And instead, science fiction is interesting because it says, fuck looking back. Let's take the same kinds of stories, but let's put them in a future world. And right. Now, normally, when we imagine future worlds, lots of times, well, we're a pretty fucking bummer-like species, so we like our dystopias. But every once in a while, you hit on a utopia that doesn't sound too scary, even though when you kind of break down the Federation, you're like, this is the fascism and blah, blah. But that doesn't matter. We'll ignore that for 5 seconds. And you just say, I'm going to create an illusion, an image in the future that people can strive to. And you look at its popularity throughout the world, and it obviously resonates with people. I think it resonates so much that, in fact, so much of our life is actually trying to imitate this show. What people think is just TV, I'm like, people thought a fucking poem once upon a time was just a fucking poem.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, the whole dystopian future fiction kind of thing is a very 19th and 20th century idea, where all of a sudden mechanized society saw the
humanity in people.
Well, saw the potentiality. I mean, you have a world war comes along where you have, you know, millions of people being killed through technology and through the advances of, you know, air travel and processing of gunpowder and things like that. So all of a sudden you see that maybe this industrial thing isn't the most positive possible potentiality for the human race. And that's where you get the dystopian thing. You have two world wars. You have 100 million people that are killed through the process of, you know, fascism and technology on a certain level. So, of course, the response to that is dystopian potentialities. And then Star Trek comes along and Star Trek says, it can be the opposite. It can be back to what, you know, it can be to that steampunk ideal of flying, you know, flying machines and
gyroplanes,
gyrocopters. Yes. That kind of a thing, but done so much more positively. And, you know, the idea of getting beyond, you know, where humanity grows the fuck up finally, you know, and realizes what's important and what's not important, and gets past the pettiness and the idea of, you know, skin color and religion and all that garbage. And yes, absolutely. It's in a small way, you know, in a small way, in a microscopic way, you know, what I try to do as a non-believer that has a tiny yet public persona is to represent as best as I can, you know, in that way of saying of that maybe when a believer sees me or meets me or sees me do something nice or has a conversation with me, that they can sort of be taken aback just for a second and think of the potentiality that, oh, wow, here's a non-believer who was a nice guy. Here's a non-believer who held the door for me. Here's a non-believer that changed my tire, you know, or whatever. Wow, is that possible? How is that possible? And then it gets them thinking. So I love that phrase, future casting. That's really cool.
Future crafting. Future casting is something different. Crafting is where you create the image yourself. And you know that's what you're doing. The thing about crafting a future, though, is you can never be sure what values are taken up, because generations change. And you can't dictate what your values are going to be, even though there's lots of people in the Tea Party that think they can.
Myth of the days, yeah.
Yeah, but nevertheless, I think it's up to us to sort of like throw out ideas and to say, well, what ideas resonate? And I think that with what you're trying to say, for instance, of being nice, it incorporates two things that I think are important. Number one, it incorporates this whole notion that you are out as a non-believer, which I still say is probably one of the most important things. It's the same reason why homosexuality is finally becoming more acceptable in mainstream American society. Something that would have taken longer if everyone just kept quiet.
Absolutely. The parallels are quite interesting, actually, yeah.
They're very interesting. And you know, the other factor too is to say, well, how we behave outside publicly. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm number one guy when it comes to fucking personal rage, especially when it, you know, of the evils that religion does. But I also say that there's this other element of a public image, a persona that we as atheists have to give, because we're like, hey, we supposedly have the without religion still answers for the future. And meanwhile, everybody's like, well, where are you going to grab them from? What's this hodgepodge of beliefs? Meanwhile, you're like, take a look at our lives. See how we lead them. Clearly, yeah. We're on to fucking something.
Exactly. It's not the easiest thing always, too. It's not the easiest thing to, you know, to be the most moral, to be the most, you know, be the most law-abiding, to be the most, you know, the best person you can be. But boy, since consciously deciding to do this, whatever it was, 10, 15 years ago, it has been much more of a protector, much more of a guide than my Catholic upbringing ever was. The Catholic upbringing was the opposite, actually, in many ways, because I knew I had an out. I knew that whatever kind of nastiness was happening, either it was justified because, you know, everyone's doing it, or I knew that as a Catholic, I had this, you know, lovely box I could go into and talk to the guy that's never been in a relationship and get, you know, get absolved. Whereas now there's no absolution. I mean, absolution doesn't exist. Maybe there's an absolution in your deeds after the fact that are completely up to you. But the specter, that's too strong of a word, but the idea, the concept of being the best you can be, because it is your responsibility as a non-believer, has affected me much greater. I've literally turned around and fixed things that, you know, where I could have fudged, I could have taken advantage of situations, and I didn't, because, you know, it's not the angel and devil on the shoulders anymore. It's, you know, it's Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson sitting there going, and they're both in agreement. You know, it's really wonderful.
Right. And I think that there's also lots of ways in which people don't, obviously you're not always going to see the benefits of the, you know, positive action. It's one of those things where I think that as hard-nosed skeptics who demand data, I think there's a part of it that we kind of want a certain level, like all human beings want this. We want to feel validation. And the endless quest for validation, unfortunately, I think, is a fool's errand. It means that what you're doing is you're still not doing good for good's sake. You're doing good for recognition.
Right.
And understanding that a lot of times, like something as simple as, you know, I've see it all, you know, because I apparently live on the internet, I see people having lots of arguments online about various things. And I realize that, say, there's two people that feel passionate about something, and what they don't realize is that they can both be losers in such an argument because of the way that they just manage it, the way that they emotionally get caught up in stuff and then have what I call stupid ass moments. And then suffer the consequences of those fucking stupid ass moments, because now they did it in a forum that is, well, permanent, visible to lots of other people too. I just don't think that people really even understand. I'm like, you should be. There's this tendency for individuals to be less cautious online because they figure, well, it's not up to someone's face, and they won't take it as personally.
Right, of course.
And they don't realize that many of these barriers that used to exist, they don't exist anymore. The associations are now beginning to be very real, but the consequences aren't equal. So now I think that what's going to happen is, especially in the future, as we become more digitalized, what's going to happen when our increasing personalities become these unpoliced monsters that can just unleash themselves and feel complete absolution, be like, oh, I just said to that person a completely crushing and cruel thing, but I'm okay. I'm fine. I can forget about it.
Yeah, I think there will be new sort of moralities and new etiquette, which will kind of work its way in.
New netiquette.
Hey. TM. Yeah, I mean, it's at every step of technological advances, you know, there are people that take it, that take advantage of technologies, and then they kind of get into the forefront of it and then maybe overstep and then get sort of hammered down, and things level out. You know, there is a bit of a pendulum to most of this kind of stuff that it does tend to kind of equal out. And, you know, people who knows? I mean, maybe we'll learn that the connectivity is more important than the material or the agreement. You know, I don't know. Who knows? Who knows, man? It's such a weird, still ultimately new thing.
Yeah.
We're just at the cusp of it.
And I think that part of like that learning that new politeness online is just I think understanding that some thoughts should be private, not always shared. I think it's a simple rule that people should abide by. Some thoughts should still remain private.
Totally. And I think that this is not new behavior. There's always been vocal idiots. You know, whether it was letters to the paper or, you know, public access cable shows or whatever, there's always been or just even at a party, there's always a vocal idiot. And the vocal idiot is never, you know, close to representing what the majority of people, how they act, how they feel, how they behave. I mean, the vast, vast, vast majority of stuff on the internet is positive. You know, the stuff that gets attention are the trolls and the negative things and the horrible things. But when you talk about sheer proportion, it's like the rest of existence. I mean, the rest of humanity is that way. There are so many just normal, decent folks that just do what they do. And the stuff that you talk about, the things that get reported, the things that are interesting to dish about, you know, is the weird stuff, is the awful stuff. But for the most part, people use technology, the internet specifically, as the incredible resource that it is. So, I mean, it's not, I don't want to say this as in any kind of worrisome way, because there's no, you can't worry about this stuff. It will level out. It'll
take care of itself.
I think so. Like most things. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, all the same stuff that's being said about the horrible, you know, every generation is just the worst it's ever been. Every generation is the dumbest. Every generation is the least polite. You know, their music is the worst. I mean, every generation, this just happens again and again. No one is immune to this. All of the same observations about rudeness and about etiquette and about the attention span, all the same arguments were made about the telephone. You know, when the telephone first came out, this was going to be the end of civilization because you didn't have to have face-to-face conversations anymore. And before that, it was the telegram. You know what? You didn't have to sit on a ship for 4 months to get from one continent to the next. What'll that mean in terms of, you know, forming your thoughts together? How will you be able to come up with anything of value or substance if you could
instantly communicate? And don't forget all the jobs, George, that would be lost from all the shipping. We can't lose all these jobs.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So it's just, you know, all this, it's fascinating to see how it really is not, they're not new concerns. You know, they're not new concerns. They're just, it just broadens in terms of its reach and its speed. You know, what took, how long was it before there was a phone in every house or a TV in every house versus how long will it be before, you know, we have whatever, brain net, you know, when that's introduced, it's going to be, you know, 4 months when it's, you know, 2020, 2030 or whatever, and they have, you know, instant brain communication. It'll be, you know, 2 weeks before everybody has it available to them.
Well, I don't know if you saw this, but they started being able to primitively record thoughts. This is not a joke. It looks
no,
like
sure.
A blurry, blurry image right now.
Right.
Oh, in 2012. Well, sure. I imagine with the level of progress that shit happens, I am going to, you know what? I'm my whole old man get off my lawn worries are at that point where my kids or grandkids are starting to do things like, we're going to hook ourselves up to the internet permanently and live there. You're just like, oh, I'm that guy saying, no, don't do it. Oh, I'm resisting new technology now.
But that's the thing, yeah. I mean, it's we will be that generation at some point. We'll cross over. I mean, already we've probably crossed over. It's just like, oh, it's too much. But, you know, that's the way it goes. I had this conversation with my mom the other day, you know, where she was sort of talking about the she doesn't understand some of the things. I mean, mom's pretty hip, actually, but, you know, some of the Facebook things, some of the Twitter things she doesn't quite understand, or this or that, you know. And I said, well, what was your mom like, you know, when you were talking on the phone in the 50s? Oh, she hated it. She didn't understand how we, like, you know, I didn't want to go to talk to my friends in person. I said, well, it's the same thing. You know, it's the same deal. And her grandkids now, that, you know, her grandkids will be, you know, a generation that won't know pre-web. I mean, that to me is amazing, to think that there's, you know, adults, people that can vote, that don't know what it was like to not have the web. I mean,
on that cusp where, because I got into it very late. I got into it in my 20s just because it was so fucking poor, like my first fucking computer in 20, for God's sakes. So I was a bit late in the game. But so I got to appreciate the world of, hey, you don't know shit, and unless you want to go to the library, but you don't have a car, so fuck you, to here's everything.
Yeah.
And it still kind of blows my mind. And I remember that everyone's reaction always with the internet is the same, especially if they were part of the older generation. My dad was like this. When he first was hearing people talking about it, he's like, they can't possibly have anything I'd be interested in. I think that's what some people think. They're like, it has everything everyone is interested in. That's the thing about it. You're just like, oh, are you interested in something?
Twice.
There's probably 1,000 sites about it.
Yeah.
You just have to know how to find it.
Right. When you get the hook in, you know, when whatever piece of technology can be applied to a person who is of an older generation, and then all of a sudden it's the greatest thing. And it's just like, oh, this is wonderful. You know, like, oh, I don't, and anything beyond that, beyond that one hook, like, oh, you can Skype your grandkids. You can see them. You know, oh, video Skype. This is amazing. This is wonderful. I love this. Well, do you want email? Well, no. What are we going to do with email? You know, and then you get email. And it's like, oh, the email is amazing. This is wonderful. This is great. And then it's like, you know, well, yeah, you can do this. Do you want a Facebook page? Well, no. Why would I need a Facebook page? This is fine. This is fine. I got the Skype thing. And then you give them a Facebook page. You can trade pictures. It's like, oh, this Facebook is great. Yeah, I was talking with my, you know, college roommate I hadn't spoken to in 30 years. So yeah, it's always you have to relate it on. You have to hook them in somehow with the thing.
Well, I think the key point of the internet is that it relates to certain elements of you that you want to be you want related, and you and I are in business for that very fucking reason. Is that the people who listen to us, listen to your stories, listen to my stories, they're desperately searching for someone who thinks about the world the same way they do, because it's a fucking isolating experience, especially some of the regions out there. I don't know about your fan base. Mine tends to be a strong, I'm isolated from everyone, and I listen to Jacob because there's no one else to talk to about this shit.
Yeah, you get those emails or even letters. I get physical letters from people saying, you know, I'm the only person in my town, my city, my state, it feels like, that thinks the same way. And it's a bit of an island when I get to listen to your show, to just, you know, have this friend come into my ears for an hour a week and relate stories that I can get, or relate situations that I can get or understand, you know, because there's no one else to necessarily talk to. Or when I answer questions on the show, I have a thing called Ask George, which I'm not an expert in anything, but if nothing else, it's people that think the same way that I think that might not have exposure to some of the resources that I have, you know, like, how do I tell my folks, you know, I don't believe, or that I don't want to go to church anymore, you know, stuff like that. Like, what's the way to approach these problems? And that's one of the most favorite parts of one of the largest benefits of doing the program that I do, is that I get to, you know, have, again, 0.1% of influence on someone's existence in a positive way, hopefully, or, you know, provide some suggestions on how to deal with something.
And it's tough to measure, because as I asked you before, you said that you're one of the fans of that you're the type of fan that doesn't really leave comments, doesn't write letters.
Right.
You just don't fall within that percentage. And so the individuals that may have had the you may have had the largest influence on are not the kinds of people that would communicate with you for whatever reason. Sure. Maybe they think to themselves, what possible thing could I tell this person, say to this person? Because again, they might be all like, I've got a creepy relationship with you, man. You really helped me out at a weird time, and you're just talking to a microphone, motherfucker.
Yeah, and so I do this thing. I have a to get past all that. Like, if I happen to meet someone in person, if I'm at a conference or I'm just at a gig or a performance, and if someone is a fan of my show, we have this thing that all you do is you walk up to me, and instead of saying, "Hey, George, I listen to the show. I like the show," you just say vibraphone. It's just a little password, a little code word that means I've listened to your show. I've listened to your show so much that I know the secret word is vibraphone. And that means that I dig what you do. And then we can just start having a conversation. And it's really cool. And it's like, it gets past all the nervousness. Because again, I know what it's like to sort of meet, and I've met almost all of my heroes. And every time I do, I'm a wreck. I'm just a complete nervous wreck. Not to equate what I am, you know, to anybody else. But I like to get to the conversation part of the conversation and to not have me feel awkward and not have the person feel awkward. So if they can just get past saying, "Hey, George, vibraphone. Cool. Hey, where are you from? Bah, 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 bah." It's awesome. And it's this nice little password. And it just gets past the first 10 minutes of the conversation into the meat of the conversation. And it's lovely.
So who did you go apeshit over?
Oh God! I mean, you know, when you're standing backstage with Richard Dawkins, and you have to tell him, you know, which mic is his, or you know, Adam Savage, you know, approaches you in a bar and wants to talk to you, you know, because like we had one conversation, you know, a year previous, you know. Yeah, I mean, let alone, you know, Michael Shermer, James Randi, you know, people that, you know, James Randi, who, I mean, it's hard for me to consider him a friend. But I guess he is. I mean, it's weird still because I'm such a just fan. I mean, there are, I've relayed this, you know, bit of information. There's like five people whose every word I have read, every book, everything I have read. And like out of those five, three of them know my name. And it's very weird and humbling. And it's just mind numbing, you know, that Richard Dawkins would come up to me and say, "Hey, I like that song that you wrote," you know, or I met, you know, Matthew Chapman, Charles Darwin's great, great grandson.
Oh, I interviewed him. He's one of the, he didn't make it to the final list of the top interviews for the DVD. What a shame. What a shame.
Okay. Nice guy, cool guy.
He's cool, I like him.
Each other, and he was like, "Oh, yeah, you're you're that funny guy." You know, it's like, shit, okay, I'm literally touching Charles Darwin's DNA.
I know, and you know what's great? He's got this seductive, smooth voice. I'm just like, wow. Every time if I was a woman, he was just talking to me, I could feel my clothes fall off just from him being like, yeah. "How's it going?" Blah, blah, blah. Just there's this pleasantness about him. I wish I could emulate such pleasantness.
The accent, baby. That's what it comes down to.
Partially.
It.
I know that's a huge thing, but there was just something. You know what I think it is? Just a cool confidence. He's like, sure. "Do you know who my grandfather was? Do you have any idea?" Yeah. I'd be that cool if I had a granddad that cool. My granddad, not so cool.
I'm sure he was cool in his own
way. No, he's
not evolutionarily, but
he was not a good person, unfortunately. I'm not saying he's a terrible person, but you ever meet someone who's always on that fine line? You're just like, well, you're a person, you've done some good, but you've done also some pretty bad that's just sort of like, I don't know what to do with you. You're just a person.
You've
never met someone like that?
Well, it's hard to tell that when you meet someone, you know, off the bat.
Don't actually know anyone like that. They're right at the cusp of, I would talk to them more, but I know that introducing them into my life might be poison.
I'm always interested. There's always something interesting with almost everybody on some level. It's just a question of, I guess, annoyance.
Some people can just really bring out the worst in you also. Maybe it's something where it's like a toxic mix of personalities and you just sort of like, let's put them in a room and then watch everybody sort of turn, where otherwise if they had more complimentary individuals around, everything would be cool. I just think that there's just certain types that just don't get along.
Really? Interesting. Yeah, see, there's I don't know, there's not many people that I can think of that I, you know, couldn't have at least a conversation with. I mean, again, it's more curiosity, morbid curiosity sometimes, or almost the challenge of it.
Yeah, but a conversation with anybody is easy. I can have a conversation with you about Haagen-Dazs, okay. And then that's fine.
Sure.
I'm talking about a conversation which both the people leaving may change their mind about something, or at least feel more enlightened, or have a real substantial discussion. I'm like, that isn't everybody.
No, that's true. That's true. There are people that just aren't interested in necessarily conversing or pushing. But even those people, I think, if you don't approach it with the idea of trying to convince anybody of anything, but that you're just sharing, that almost to a person, I'm trying to think, like, you can always get something interesting out of somebody. I don't know. That's curious. Maybe I'm more of a placator, I guess.
You're a nice guy. Like, that was the whole thing. I think that the reason you started the podcast, from my research, was that you showed up at you made friends at a skeptical conference, and everybody was like, "You should just do a podcast, man. You're cool."
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was my best friend too is visually impaired. So Slough has been blind since he's 27. And so podcasts are, you know, pretty much all his entertainment. And he was in on the podcast train very, very early, 2004, 2005, and was saying, "Hey, podcasts are the way to go."
He's even more old than us. He's a podcast elder.
That's right. That's right. Yes, he holds the staff of Earl.
No, the sacred microphone of truth.
That's it. So he was one that sort of kept saying, you know, you'd be into this. You not only should you listen to this stuff, and it could help you, but you should maybe do one. And he kept sort of suggesting that subtly for years, until I finally thought, you know what, let's try it. So I had done.
You had experience though doing radio.
I did. Yeah, I did one summer's worth of like radio at a local college here, and I had done a little bit of radio in when I was in college too. This is a school here locally that for the summer they open up their airwaves to local people that want to do programs. And I sort of approached it, approached the program manager, and I said, "Can I do a show that doesn't have music? Is that cool?" And he was like, "You can do whatever you want." So he gave me Tuesdays like 11 to 2 in the morning. And it became kind of a lab where I tried out different things and tried, okay, can I just bullshit for 3 hours? Can I just talk for 3 hours? And what does that involve? And when do I find I need material, or what am I wearing out? Or what are the kinds of things that I can do that will work in that format and that could maybe be refreshed week after week? So I did like 13, 14 shows like that. And after that, I sort of kept the bits that worked and got rid of the bits that didn't and started doing the podcast. And that was just, you know, I wanted to do half hour a week, maybe do 50 shows, maybe do it for a year. That very quickly turned to 45 minutes to an hour. And here we are 5 years in.
And I went back and listened to episode number one. Is that really your first episode? Because if it is, you begin by essentially reading not reading a letter, but paraphrasing a letter from someone who hated your show. That's an interesting way to start a podcast.
Yeah, sure. I don't remember what I did, but yeah, that first one was the first one. So
yeah, no, that's what you did. The first podcast. I'm actually happy now. It sort of proves I'm a good researcher. Your first podcast is interesting because it is from someone who I guess had been listening to the college show, and they had made a specific request to find out when you were on so that they could know when to not listen to it.
Oh, okay. Yes, it's coming back to me now. Yes, the bile is starting to bubble up again. Yeah,
yeah. I figured if I laid the story out effectively enough, anger would seep right through, and then it is strong inside of you. I can feel it.
Soon that everybody will be crushed. Yes.
Well, I thought that was amusing. I mean, like, it's pretty gutsy, really, to put that out there.
I'm a hero. That's what I am, definitely. No, I mean, it's content. You know, that's the thing. And you know that bile can drive you. You know, vitriol. I mean, one of my albums is called Vitriol. You know, so I know that that can be a force. I mean, I often the negative thing, if you channel it right, is the best kind of incentive or motivator. You know, for me to write a song or to do a bit after being frustrated or mad or confused is the best thing. You know, rarely, it's not impossible, but rarely is the enlightened moment entertaining in the recounting of it. The much more entertaining thing is, you know, getting your dick slammed in a toilet seat. I mean, that's just, you just, you're going to tell that story in a much more entertaining way. Not that it's, like I said, impossible to have enlightenment and share that. That's a different kind of
or
thing.
Or perhaps enlightenment from slamming your dick in a toilet seat.
Yeah, yeah, that's, well, that's the last time I go to that confessional. But it's all about content, you know, and whatever it takes. I mean, you know, I don't know how many shows in you are, but you know that it gets to a point of like, okay, whatever I can talk about, I'm going to talk about. And often it's the negative things that tend to drive a better story.
Well, we have passed episode 300 a while
ago. Wow, good for you.
But the thing is, the numbering is all messed up because I used to have a bonus show and I did 100 of those. But I named them the bonus show numbers. So I'm all kinds of fucked up. So essentially what I'm waiting to do is I'm having a bit of a reboot moment so that by the time we get onto the official episode 200, I'd be like, nah, it's 300. And if people ask, what happened to 100 shows? I'd be like, here's the lengthy explanation, but I'm sick and tired of having 100 shows that are behind saying like, oh, well, how many have you done? Well, there's an 100 more that was behind a wall.
Wow. Why were the bonus shows the bonus shows? What made them bonus-y or...
Well, I back in the early days when I started podcasting, we introduced another... I used to do a show a week. So we introduced a second show every week for paying members.
Oh,
and
okay.
So that's how I made my living for a long time. But, you know, it turns out that over... Well, I've kind of changed my pitch over time. I still have members who pay me, but now I've done the 2 weeks... two shows a week are completely free. But now people have to pay for the backlog. That's essentially the deal now. Or they're gotcha. Soon, in a couple of weeks, they're going to be able to buy the Essentials DVD, which is sort of like the best of, best interviews, and all this other kind of stuff. So I'm trying. Now I've produced so much content now that it's actually easier for me to organize it, even as a best of. Because I'm like, who's going to go back and listen but a hardcore that's going to pay $5 a month anyways? Because it's going to take them a long time to go through that shit.
How's that working out? I mean, are people doing it? They're buying the archive
stuff?
Oh,
yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I have some members, in fact, cool. that pay more than the $5, because the $5 is the beginning part. But,
sure.
you know, I want to kind of introduce this idea that people can donate more a month, because there's some serious people who love that shit and they want more of it.
Sure.
And cool. especially seeing as how it's my full-time job. So... That's yeah, kind of need yeah. them as kind of need them as a rallying people to support it. I mean, the more I do it, the better the stuff gets. Anyways, we're at regular scheduled podcasts. We have great interviews with great guests like you, George.
Hey, see how it all
I
works
know,
out.
It's sort of it comes back full circle, and you're like, man, what are the advantages? And I'm like, we get to have cool guests that I've wanted to talk to since I started researching you and gave you a fair shot at listening to your show. I told you. It threw me off because I seriously thought, you know, a geological subject would not hold my attention for a podcast. I will admit that was my...
What was the first one you listened to? I mean, did you jump into later things or earlier things?
I remember back when I tried, I think it was like in your high 100 episodes, like maybe episode 178 or 200 when I tried. But I was just generally still confused about what everything is. In fact, all your interviews, generally speaking... Everybody asks, what is your show about? I mean, I finally figured it out off of all of the research. It's about you.
Yeah. Yeah. Ultimately. I mean, there's three levels of strata for the show, but it all relates to me. Yeah. It's me as a professional musician. It's me as a non-believer. And then it's me being silly. That's basically the three things. So,
and if you like a silly man, and you know, here's the most surprising thing about what you do. I don't think I could do it specifically the way you do it, because I need another person to talk to. You talk to a mic. I tried that and I sound crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird sort of skill, not skill, but it's a weird pastime.
No, you can call it a skill, because, you know, honestly, there are some days where, say, my guest hosts are not feeling so good, or you can just tell it's going to be a terrible show with them. You're just like, well, the show must go on. And, or you're just feeling totally out of it, even though you've scheduled the show for that day and you have to be the one who's just sort of like, I'm going to drag the show down now. And
my turn.
Yeah, you get a little bit more freedom, because sort of when you're on that high, and I know I've had plenty of times where I'm like, man, I could do a badass show right now. Who wants to do a show? And I just get like, you know, people looking the other way, and they're like, yeah, I don't want to do a show. You're like, fuck, that would have been a great show, but you don't have that problem.
Maybe we'll do a bonus show. That's it. Yeah, a bonus show. Double bonus show, which is $100.
We don't do the bonus thing anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it's I've developed a system where it I don't want to say it's super efficient, but it's more efficient than it used to be. And you know, I know that at my worst, at my lowest, with nothing to talk about, I still can probably pull out, you know, 45 minutes of something because of the support of my listeners, who are constantly sending me either, you know, the religious moron of the week or interesting fauna or questions or just, hey, this is a cool article, you should check this out, I thought of you, or did you see this thing, or is this real, or what do you think of this, or what happened here? And I can, you know, go into my special mailbag, which is, depending on the spelling, either sexy or not, but and pull out something cool and then just talk about it. And then, like you said, I can kind of, if I'm on a roll, I can continue. And if I'm not, I can kind of stop and take a second and not worry that I'm wasting anyone's time. And then just cut it all together and make it sound like I'm just off the cuffingly brilliant.
So when you're not recording podcasts, you're recording music. Is there other stuff that you do? Like what is a normal week for you? What exactly, other than recording a podcast, what else do you do?
Well, I mean, my day job, quote unquote, that's the phrase I always use, but my day job is playing drums. I mean, I'm a drummer in a band, a 9-piece funk band. That's, you know, we do about 100 gigs a year. So pretty much Friday, Saturday, sometimes Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday are with that band, you know, driving to places, setting up and playing, whether it's private events or concerts or your corporate gigs or clubs or whatever. That's how I make my nut for the most part. So that's, you know, that's 2 days a week, four days a week of playing. A day or two is working on the podcast, and then the other days are writing material, because I do put out albums, just straight ahead music albums.
Well, you also do a show. I think you do. I remember watching a show you did in Stockholm, I think in 2011. There should be a link for it in the notes as well.
That was a fun
show.
I think you did
in that show, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a live concert. Yeah, those are some of the most fun I have, is that I do these kind of, they're sort of like house concerts, but what people do, a lot of skeptical groups or free-thinking groups or critically thinking groups or atheist groups will get in touch with me and they say, hey, you know, if we fly you out to Denver or to Los Angeles or to London, like, would you come and do a show? We have a bar, or we have this guy's house, or we have a club. You know, would you do a show? And I do songs, and I do Q&A, and I do maybe some sketches or whatever. That's the most fun I've had. You know, have been traveling the world literally and doing these shows. You know, for like-minded people, which is really nice. The show that was in Stockholm was part of what we call the Golden Ticket Tour. The Golden Ticket Tour was something that came with my last album. The last record I had was called Trebuchet, and within one of the albums, the physical CDs. In order to kind of promote,
you did
the
a Charlie and Chocolate
purchasing.
Factory thing.
Oh, exactly. The deal was that if you got this ticket, I'd come to your house and do a show. Well, the person that got it lived in Finland, so we arranged. I was going to be in Manchester, emceeing this QED conference, Question, Explore, Discover conference, which is a free thought science based conference. They asked me to host that, so they flew me out there. And while I was there, I did a couple of house concerts. I did one in London, did one in Dublin, and then did the Scandinavian tour, because a bunch of Scandinavian free-thinking groups said, hey, George Robb is going to be essentially in town. We should, you know, raise some funds and get him to come to not only Helsinki, which is where the Golden Ticket show was going to be, but to Oslo and to Gothenburg. And I did shows there. So it was this weird, you know, I talked about it on the show, on the podcast. Said, hey, if you buy a thing, you might win a ticket, you know, and it's led to some of the coolest experiences of my life, that I get to meet these incredible people that are, you know, not only like-minded, but are just genuinely wonderful humans and are into my stuff. And I did the same thing in Australia. You know, I did a 6-city tour of Australia because I was asked to be involved in the amazing meeting in Australia in Sydney. And a bunch of Australians said, hey, you're in town. You're on our continent. Do you want to do a show in Brisbane? And my thing is, if you organize it, I'll do it. You know, if I don't have to pay anything, I'll do it. And, you know, I sell CDs and whatever, and subsequently meet cool people and make a little bit of money and have just this amazing time and get to see these towns from an insider's perspective. So I get to go to Christchurch and Adelaide and Cairns and Brisbane and see, you know, where do free thinkers hang out on a Friday night in Brisbane? Oh, here, cool.
And there are people there.
It's surreal.
There are people probably listening to themselves, man, how available is he for that kind of thing? Like, because generally speaking, you've got that drumming thing, whatever. So if someone thinks to themselves, I could put on a show, because, you know, you, from what, at least what I saw, I mean, I you know, dating someone who's in the biz, entertainment business, I know how hard it is to just put together a long show. So I'm like, that's already, anybody who's trying to put together, saying, like, I want to get atheists together and do something a little bit different than the standard conference thing. I mean, your show is a good alternative to that kind of thing. It's got music, it's got comedy, it's really an outing that people can come to. So I'm sure that there's lots of people, lots of small groups and things like that, thinking to themselves, shit, how easy is it to get you booked?
It's much easier than you would think.
What's the first thing they need to do, man?
Get in touch with me. Drop me an email, you know, geo@geologicrecords.net, or go to my Facebook page, or just Google my name, H-R-A-B is my last name, and it's ubiquitous enough that the first 120,000 things are me. So if you get in touch with me in any of those ways, and you have an organization that wants to have an event, or have, you know, just a night or whatever. Now, I'm in Pennsylvania, and I can drive, you know, I drive all the time. So for me to drive 5-6 hours in one direction is not a big deal.
He's got
deal.
A radius, folks. Now you know. Go and look at the map.
Yeah, before flights, you know, but people have flown me out too, and it's not that crazy, you know, to book a flight and get me a place to stay. You know, for the most part, depending on what the organization is, I mean, yeah, we have, there's remuneration and there's all kinds of things and there's the standard fees, but all this stuff is negotiable. You know, depends on time of year, depends, you know, if it's a Tuesday, you know, I'm much more available than I would be on a Saturday. You know, a Tuesday in February is very available versus a Saturday in July.
And what
July.
About your own fans, like somebody who might be thinking, you know, if I book them or something like that, do you generally have, is there a fan base that comes to your concerts and stuff like that when you put them on too?
It's the thing is that, you know, I've done shows from, you know, 15 people up to 1,200, you know, or 1,500. So it's whatever you want. I did a show in someone's living room in London 2 years ago. And I loved it because there was no it was maybe 20 people, maybe no amplification, just me and a guitar.
They could hear you just fine.
Oh my God, I could have done 4 hours. It was so much fun. It was so much fun. So that's you know, not to say that I don't mind having a big PA system and doing all kinds of stuff, you know, with a large setting as well. It's totally great. But it's the beauty of what I'm doing. It can be as big or as small as you want it to be. And I love that interconnectivity. So if you and a couple of friends want to, you know, have me come down, you can swing it so that, you know, my out-of-pocket costs are zero. That's sort of essential. Yeah, get in touch.
Well, there you go. I think that's an enticing thing. And is there any other way to, right now, a person who's digging your stuff, what should they check out?
Yeah, if you go to georgehrob.com, that is the portal to everything. And that will connect you with iTunes. I have 6 albums worth of material. You know, probably about 60% of it is of a sort of scientific, atheist, geeky nature, but it's not, they're not joke songs. It's not, you know, like, you know, logical fallacy, hey, logical, it's nothing.
Is
it's
it
not
a bit
like
closer
that.
To They Might Be Giants and their album about science? Is it closer to that?
I hope. I mean, people have compared me to, you know, XTC, Frank Zappa, They Might Be Giants, and I very humbly, I mean, my stuff is, if you were to combine Frank Zappa, King Crimson, Talking Heads, and Stan Freberg, that's my oeuvre is kind of a shittier version of those people's.
It's a humbler version of this. That's what it is.
Yeah. that's what it is. There's 6, like I said, there's 6 albums worth of material on iTunes. You can buy physical albums as well, which I, you know, we really craft the albums to be part of the experience. You know, we've won art awards for our albums, which is kind of cool, like advertising and art awards, national awards. You really get a secondary experience. I'm a guy, you know, from my generation, I liked albums and I liked cassettes that had stuff inside that you would unfold
and read. Well,
you rock
the retro look. I mean, you have an affectation to the 20th century. It's cool. I do too.
I hear you. No, it's you know, that was our, I realized, like, that was our internet. You know, when you would buy a Rush cassette in 1990, and you would unfold it. That was their website, you know, because that was the only information you had available to you was there. So we would absorb it all and love it all. So to me, I like that additional experience of reading lyrics and seeing an art piece, an objet that has to do with the listening experience. It's not essential, but it's an extra little bonus that if you do buy an album, you do get that kind of fun stuff. So you can get that on iTunes. A podcast, obviously, is geologicpodcast.com. Where it showed, you know, I just a half hour ago or an hour ago finished to show 284. Our archives are available for free because, you know, I don't want to charge people because that's just
don't
gross.
Don't denigrate my product. My product is awesome.
So that's there. And I have a book that you can also get. It's an ebook, which is just a series of essays. And like I said, if you Google HRAB, there's plenty of stuff that's there and it's available, you know, Facebook, Twitter.
Awesome. I hope that's going to be something new for people to check out. I mean, you've got a lot of content there that people can just go back and listen to and lose themselves. Because, I mean, remember, so much of the people that we just talked to have very boring commutes. And we help them. We help them in their boring lives.
It's music. It's, you know, I mean, for my birthday last year, I decided to do, you know, an all-piano version of Dark Side of the Moon. So that's what that episode was, you know. And then the following episode after that was just talking about, you know, some new bizarre spiders that were found in Brazil. So it really jumps all over the place.
It's
so
the product of a schizophrenic mind.
Totally, because because I'm allowed.
Well, you're a very creative, expressive person. You can tell from the show. He's got tons of things that are going on in his head all the time. Some of it may not always make sense to people, including myself. But you know what? I think that's the cost of free expression.
That's right. Yeah, everything has a price, you know.
Clarity sometimes gets lost in free expression.
As I get older, I think that is the one thing that becomes truer and truer is that everything has its price. Relating even back to the story, what we were talking about earlier about the internet and stuff like that. If you want this incredible resource that will have not only what you love, but 15 versions of what you love and you know, competing versions of that very specific kind of fetishistic thing that you enjoy. If you want that, well, you're going to have to wade through LOL cats. That's the price. That's the way it works.
The double price. But oh, the diamond is so beautiful and sparkly. You just want it. That golden nugget as you learn to filter out through the noise that is the internet. The hard work person has to find to find the things that they love, and hopefully that's the two of us for someone out there. Maybe someone who's probably, there's probably tons of fans, in fact. Because I know from the Suggest podcast, they suggest yours a lot. So for somebody, we made their fucking day, dude.
Cool. Love connection.
Yeah. It's all, they're having a good day, whatever. By then, it's like a Monday. And you know how horrible Mondays are. We just gave somebody a great Monday. They're at work and they're like, wow, I can't believe that happened. That's neat. That's like a crossover between, you know, Spider-Man and Batman.
Yeah, makes it all worthwhile. Makes it almost all worthwhile. Makes it just about almost worth. Just almost barely makes it worth it. You know, I'd like to think that it's worthwhile, but it's probably not.
I thought, now you're making my overconfidence just so much larger. I hate it. I'm going to have to sort of like pump you back up here. You're deflating yourself. Not before the end of the show. You're my guest now. And my last question was going to be in my whole Batman, Spider-Man analogy. Which one are you? Are you Batman or are you Spider-Man?
Batman's the best because everyone could be Batman. The Batman, it just, you can't deny how great Batman is because
I can spend all day denying how great Batman is.
Potentially, it is the ultimate superhero because in and of its own creation, the potentiality of it is within each and every human being. You will not be bitten by an irradiated spider. You will not come from the planet Krypton. You will not be exposed to radiation that will give you some kind of telepathic method. However, you could, through sheer force of will and training and monetary gain, become Batman.
Right.
And that is the
But by that logic, Iron Man is better. Because he does it,
well,
and
sure.
He does it better.
Okay.
He has a suit that protects him that's pretty smart, can lift up things that are really heavy. It doesn't make you fragile.
Okay, I'll give you that. However, his power source, that's almost crossing over into the supernatural kind of thing. The arc thing is a bit, it's almost, you know, that in essence is a scientific.
We're just so close. Come on, it's like. You got to forgive things. It's like a warp drive. You know it's coming. You don't think there's going to be a power source that you could fit on your chest that could power an exoskeleton and moves around? Say hello to the future, man. We're going to do it. That's a future craft right there. Iron Man.
Bingo.
We're all going to be Iron Man, like, flying around and shit like that on other planets and be totally bored by it.
Right, right. It'll be. We'll complain about how our thrust is not as good as it should be. Can you? Stupid. My thrusters are so stupid.
Everything sucks.
Oh my god. I can only go like suborbit. This is so stupid. Fucking Verizon.
What a piece of shit. All right, George, thanks for coming on the show.
It was fun, man. Good luck to you, brother.
All right, everybody. Have a good Atheist Day.